From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And there are questions today after President Trump's meeting yesterday with California leaders opposed to their state's sanctuary city policies. Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims said they prevent her from telling immigration officials about jailed undocumented immigrants, even if she thinks they're in gangs. Here's Trump's response.
We have people coming into the country, trying to come in. We're stopping a lot of them. But we're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before.
Now, the Trump administration is suing California. The state says requiring local officials to work with immigration officers erodes trust in local police. But the president's comments have caused some controversy. So what's true? USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez is here. Alan, start with illegal crossings into the U.S. They typically increase in the spring with seasonal workers. What are we seeing?
Well, if you ask the White House, they are seeing an unprecedented, never-before-seen increase in border crossings. According to the Department of Homeland Security, they say in April of this year, there was a 227% increase from April of 2017. That sounds like a very jarring stat. But when you put these numbers in historical context, we're right at normal range for the past, say, 10 years. We used to catch up over a million people crossing the border a year. That was back in the 2000s. We're on pace right now for about 360-some thousand.
Well, but still, the recent months have been the highest monthly totals since President Trump took office. And we know he's very upset about this. We know he berated his Homeland Security chief, Kirstjen Nielsen. She and Attorney General Jeff Sessions have said that they're going to file criminal charges against anyone crossing illegally. Now, some people might be saying, wait, that you don't already do that? It is illegal. Why isn't it a criminal charge? So is this unusual that it's going to be a criminal charge?
Yeah, in federal law, it is a criminal charge if you cross the border between ports of entry, but historically it's been treated more like a civil violation. It's only when you rack up 2, 3, 4, 5 illegal crossings, when you develop a criminal record in the United States, that all of a sudden those crossings reach a criminal level where they're prosecuted as such. And so, yes, Attorney General Jeff Sessions instituting what he's referring to as a zero tolerance policy, where anybody caught crossing the border between those ports of entry will be treated criminally, and then their children get separated from them if they're coming as a family, and they're facing prison time on top of a eventual deportation.
We'll talk about that. The Trump administration pushing for this policy of separating the undocumented immigrant children from their parents, who, as you said, will be charged criminally. The Trump administration is talking about possibly using military bases to house them. How does this work? Don't you need people to take care of them?
And that's where Congress has a lot of questions. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen has been in front of a couple of committees in the last couple of weeks, and that's one of the things that she's been asked about the most. She hasn't been able to tell them how many children they've separated from their parents. They haven't been able to provide sort of what the training, what that process is going to be like. It ends up being Health and Human Services, the federal agency that will end up taking care of them. But right now, there's a lot of questions for such what's going to be a dramatic increase in the number of children, foreign children that are in this country, and we're still not quite sure how they're all going to be taken care of.
Well, and we understand that the places where the children might be put now are almost at capacity because there's so many of them. I was taken by another statistic that 5 years ago, families with children and unaccompanied minors made up about 10% of illegal border crossings. Now it's up to 40%, and this is of those detained so that they can get that stat. What does that say to you, that so many more families with children are coming?
Remember, traditionally, the last 10, 20 years, undocumented immigration into this country has been predominantly young working age males coming over here to work. And so what you're left with is a lot of cities back in Central America where mostly you see mothers and children. And as the violence in places like Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala has just gotten so out of hand, we're talking about some of the murder capitals of the world, that's what you're left with is those mothers, those children trying to get over here any way they can. So the administration will say that they're just trying to take advantage of our immigration law. But if you talk to a lot of them, they'll say, no, this is just the only way we know how to find a safe place to live.
Well, let's get your thoughts on one last claim the president made, that we're taking them out of the country at a rate that's never happened before. What is true about the deportation numbers?
Well, that is not right. What the administration has done is dramatically increased the number of undocumented immigrants arrested in what they refer to as the interior of the country. So ICE agents going out and rounding up undocumented immigrants living in the country. Those numbers are up. They're up some 40% overall. The number of undocumented immigrants without a criminal record is also going up quite dramatically. But deportations are actually down. These are cases that take a long time to process, and there was already a very, very large backlog in the immigration court system before President Trump came into the office. So you pile on all those extra arrests, and it's slowing the process down, and it's making it harder for them to deport them and get them out of the country.
Alan Gomez, USA Today immigration reporter, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to a closely watched congressional race in Northern Virginia. Republican incumbent Barbara Comstock is fighting to hang on to a district where President Trump is unpopular and she's had to keep distancing herself from him. Comstock's vulnerability has led to a flood of well-funded Democratic opponents for the June 12th primary. As Patrick Madden of member station WAMU reports, their biggest challenge may be keeping the focus on the incumbent.
Virginia's 10th district has been held by Republicans for nearly four decades. But like the rest of Northern Virginia, it's been trending bluer each cycle.
This is a district that Hillary Clinton won by 10 points.
That's Lindsay Davis Stover, one of the Democrats running for the seat.
There is absolutely no way to take back the House without coming through the streets of Virginia 10. And Virginia 10 residents know that.
Earlier this month, Stover and her five opponents met for a candidates forum at a fancy Italian restaurant in Tyson's Galleria, a high-end shopping mall once dubbed the Rodeo Drive of the East Coast. Virginia's 10th is a wealthy district, with a higher median income than any other congressional district outside of California's 17th, Silicon Valley.
How are you engaging younger voters and bringing them into the field?
There were no verbal fireworks at the recent candidates' breakfast. In truth, the six Democrats don't disagree on much in terms of policy or politics, but their backgrounds are vastly different. An Army veteran, a scientist, a prosecutor, a PR pro, a human trafficking expert, and a Virginia state senator. The challenge facing all of them, how do you separate from the pack? One candidate relied on an undercover video. Dan Helmer, the Army veteran, made national headlines a few weeks back for a video he shot, which highlighted Virginia's so-called gun show loophole. The video shows him buying an AR-15 without a background check in under 10 minutes.
An incredibly dangerous piece of weaponry that's meant for war.
Gun policy has emerged as a top issue for the Democrats running. They believe Comstock support from the NRA could hurt her among the district's suburban voters. And the candidates are also fighting amongst themselves over the issue. Helmer has criticized one of his opponents for supporting a legislative deal that created tougher gun laws for domestic abusers and in return expanded gun rights for concealed carry permit holders.
Yeah, it's been called a compromise. It wasn't a compromise vote. We need legislators who don't have a history of supporting liberalizing concealed carry laws. This isn't about knocking people down. This is about making sure that we elect candidates who are going to fight for our values.
The fellow Democrat Helmer is criticizing is State Senator Jennifer Wexton. She's considered the front runner in the race and the only one with experience in elected office.
I'm the only candidate in this race who has a record, and that record is that I have had a failing grade from the gun lobby. I've never taken a dime from the gun lobby, and I've been endorsed by the coalition to stop gun violence.
Virginia's 10th is the quintessential Washington district that benefits from both direct and indirect federal government spending. Trump's call to drain the swamp doesn't exactly resonate here. Most of the country's biggest defense companies, IT firms, and government contractors call Northern Virginia home. At the forum, the candidates pledge to fight proposed budget cuts and layoffs and what they see as Trump's radical reshaping of many federal agencies. Candidate Julia Biggins is a doctor specializing in infectious diseases.
Given the events of the last year and the way the Trump administration is so dismissive of science, really frightened me as to what is going to happen to science in this country.
The showdown in Virginia's 10th district is expected to draw a lot of attention and money from the national parties this fall, and already donations are pouring in from around the country. The six Democratic candidates, most of them political newcomers, have raised a combined $4.5 million. It's a big amount, nearly double what Comstock has raised so far. Some, like Allison Friedman, an ex-State Department official, have already bought TV spots criticizing the incumbent.
I approved this message because my opponent, Congresswoman Barbara Comstock, sold our kids' safety to the NRA. I'm running to take it back.
As the June 12th primary gets closer, the question is whether this crowd of well-funded candidates keeps the focus on Comstock or turns on each other. As the forum wrapped up, Sherry Lejeune, a longtime Democratic activist in the district, stayed to talk with the candidates.
The 10th is unique. All of our people are pretty much the same in terms of, wow, I wish I could vote for all of them.
Her biggest concern, her top issue, which one will be the best at taking on Comstock? The Republican eked out a tough win 2 years ago. Democrats don't want to let another chance go by. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Madden.
In Malaysia, there's a new prime minister, and he's the oldest elected leader in the world. 92-year-old Mahathir Mohamad, who previously had the job for more than two decades, took power back last week. Joining us now is the BBC's Jonathan Head. He's in Kuala Lumpur, the capital of Malaysia. Jonathan, let's start with, who is Mahathir Mohamad?
Well, you know, people call him the father of Malaysian modernization. He really is one of the towering figures in this region's history, not just this country's history. He has been in politics since 1946. He is an astonishing 92 years old. And I can tell you, I have never seen anybody that age or even 10 years younger with as much energy and as much political savvy as he's displayed in recent weeks. He first became prime minister in 1981, and he presided over the very rapid growth of Malaysia. It was one of the great, they called them the Asian Tigers, that grew enormously rapidly in the first year of globalization. And he held on to power for 22 years, then made sure that his own chosen successor took over, didn't like him, had him ousted, and then put the most recently ousted prime minister, Najib Razak, into power, and then has turned on him by joining the opposition. You know, there is no bigger figure in a country than Mahathir Mohamad.
Well, and let's talk about that former prime minister, because one of the first things that's happened under the new rule of Mahathir Mohamad is that police raided and searched the home of the man he defeated last week, the former prime minister, Najib Razak. What's going on there?
Anyone who's watched Malaysia in recent years knows that the rule of law has been definitely undermined very severely by Prime Minister Najib, although Dr. Mahathir in his day in the 90s was accused also of being very autocratic. But under Prime Minister Najib, we had this massive corruption scandal. It's known as 1MDB. It's basically a government-linked investment body that Mr. Najib set up, in which he promised to raise money on global capital markets and buy assets for Malaysia's future as a sort of investment. The US Department of Justice has been investigating it, as have authorities in five other countries, and have found that perhaps as much as $4.5 billion was stolen or misappropriated from this fund by friends of the prime minister. Nearly $700 million is alleged to have gone into former Prime Minister Najib's personal bank account. But there was never a proper investigation in Malaysia itself. It was shut down. An attorney general who was investigating it 2.5 years ago was sacked. Now Dr. Mahathir's victory and the victory of the opposition, very unexpected, has allowed the new government to restart the investigation, and nobody is too surprised to see a police raid, even this early on Prime Minister Najib's home. I've never seen a downfall like this. A man who had total power over the country and party just over a week ago, Prime Minister Najib now has been abandoned by all his friends and political allies and is simply sitting at home awaiting his fate.
We're also reading that Mahathir is only going to run the country for 1 or 2 years and that he's sort of a caretaker for another politician who helped him win the election. Tell us about Anwar Ibrahim.
Well, this whole thing is a bit like an extraordinary soap opera or even a Shakespeare play, because you have to remember Mahathir Mohamad groomed this Anwar Ibrahim to be his successor in the 90s when Malaysia was doing so well. They disagreed very profoundly over the then Asian financial crisis where Malaysia and all the other countries in this region suffered badly. He was sacked. Then he was accused of corruption and sodomy, charges he's always said were trumped up, and he was put in prison under Dr. Mahathir. He got out, led an opposition movement that challenged the government, and was then jailed again by the last prime minister, Najib. And now Dr. Mahathir, who was for years a bitter rival of Anwar Ibrahim and insisted he had to stay in prison, has had a change of heart. So Anwar Ibrahim was released from custody. He was instantly pardoned by Malaysia's constitutional monarch just 24 hours ago, and he is now a free man. But the deal is that Dr. Mahathir runs the government now because he ran the election campaign as the prime ministerial candidate, but that he will step aside. Everyone keeps wondering, will this happen? These two men have been such rivals in the past. There's been mistrust. Will it happen? Dr. Mahathir insists it will. And Anwar Ibrahim told me yesterday when I interviewed him, he said he is totally comfortable to let Dr. Mahathir run the country now. He's doing a superb job. He knows how to do it. And that he will wait his turn and be happy to take over in a couple of years.
So politics aside, what are the big challenges facing Malaysia right now? And we have to think about where it is. It's not too far away from China, which I know is already building a rail line as part of its One Belt, One Road initiative down right through Kuala Lumpur to Singapore.
I think Malaysia has some of the same challenges that all the fast-growing economies in this region have, which is how to keep up this economic growth. It's been very fast, but it's very unequal. There's a huge income gap, and there's also massive amounts of corruption. You know, the institutions have not kept up with people's living standards and with the amount of money the country's making. You're right about bringing in China. China is now, without any doubt, the superpower in this region, and all the countries have adjusted to it. In some cases, smaller countries like Cambodia, they've totally capitulated, let China more or less take over huge swathes of land. Other middle-sized countries like Malaysia and Thailand are trying to balance China with other powers like India and, of course, the United States and Europe. And Malaysia, under former Prime Minister Najib, did seem to swing quite closely to China, even though Najib himself considers himself a very close personal friend of Donald Trump. They get on quite well together, and was close to President Obama before him. But Chinese influence has grown a lot. We are seeing a lot of Chinese investment, and a lot of Malaysians are very uneasy about it. And so the new government is saying they do want to revisit that. They want to look at some of these big infrastructure projects and actually see whether they're valid or not.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Head joining us from Kuala Lumpur. Sounds like a very interesting situation going on there politically. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to talk to you.
It is hard to keep up with the newest technology, but the latest isn't always the greatest, and sometimes older technology works better than the next big thing. KUOW's John Ryan brings us the story of a centuries-old device made by the Makah tribe on the Olympic Peninsula. Scientists have confirmed it gets at least one job done that modern technology has failed at.
On a foggy morning in May, 3 years ago, about 20 people hopped aboard a charter boat at the tribal marina near Nia Bay. That's at the remote northwest corner of the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. The Makah call it the beginning of the world. As the sun rose through the fog, they left the harbor and headed out to the Pacific Ocean. They were going fishing for halibut, something their ancestors had been doing for thousands of years. On the boat was Rosina DePoe. Rosina, did I say the right kind of use? Introduce yourself. Who
yes.
are you?
Hi there. My name is Rosina DePoe, and I am a Makah tribal member from Nia Bay, Washington.
DePoe says it was a great day to be out on the water.
It was just a lot of fun because I don't get to go out fishing very often. We got 30 minutes to catch as much fish as possible. We all dropped our hooks at the same time, and as soon as we felt a fish bite, we'd reel it up and we'd get it onto the boat as quickly as possible.
But it wasn't just fun. It was science. The anglers were volunteers in an experiment. They were trying to see how an age-old Makah tool measures up against modern technology.
Each of us had our own fishing rod, and each rod was alternating a circle hook or a chibut.
A circle hook is what charter boats and the commercial fishing industry use to reel in big fish like halibut. Chibut is the Makah word for the hook the tribe used to use.
So chibut is the historical traditional version of a halibut hook. So it's how we fished halibut before modernization, I guess.
In the Makah language, food and fish are the same word. But when it comes to fishing gear, Makah vocabulary and technology are very specific.
This hook was known for specifically just getting halibut, not anything else. So it limited bycatch.
Bycatch is the word for a big problem with fishing today. It means hauling up the wrong type of fish. They often end up dead, even if you throw them back in the sea. Today, much of the ocean off the Washington coast is off limits to halibut fishing because of the toll it takes on another species.
So this really pretty fish here, this is a yellow-eyed rockfish.
That's biologist Jonathan Scordino speaking at a scientific conference in Seattle. He works for the Macaw tribe. He says rockfish can live a century or more and are very slow to reproduce.
And because of that, they're very sensitive to overfishing.
Washington State counts 13 kinds of rockfish as species of concern. Two of them are protected under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Originally, chibut hooks were made by steaming a piece of hemlock, bending it into a big curvy U, and lashing a sharp piece of bone onto it. Scordino says the macaw adopted newer materials when they became available.
When the U.S. government gave them pitchforks to work their land, they knocked off the tines and made them into fish hooks.
Volunteers from the macaw community helped Scordino handcraft a bunch of chibut out of brass. Then it was time to test them out at sea. Scordino says the macaw's traditional chibut hooks did well.
We found that this hook was extremely selective for halibut. 91% of the fish hooked were halibut.
That's much better than the modern circle hooks did. Nearly half the fish they caught were not halibut. And those pretty rockfish? The chibut only snagged 3 of them. The circle hooks, more than 100. On the downside, the chibut didn't catch as many halibut overall. Scordino thinks it may be that some of the volunteer-made chibut weren't shaped right, or that the anglers were inexperienced at using the historical hooks. Now he's working to improve the manufacturing of the chibut and test out materials from steel to plastic. That's important because gathering food from the sea is still essential on the Macaw Reservation. The average income there is about half the national average. Rosina DePoe says the chibut study reinforces her belief that tribal traditions can help solve modern problems.
It made me feel proud to see that we had innovations before people, before settlers even had it.
Jonathan Scordino says the old technology could let the macaw hook halibut again in rockfish protection areas that have been off limits for the past 20 years. For Here and Now, I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
Women in the U.S. are having children at the lowest rate in over 100 years. This is according to new numbers from the National Center for Health Statistics. Last year, there were 60 births for every 1,000 women between the ages of 15 to 44. That's down 3%. In fact, in 2017, women had 500,000 fewer babies than women did in 2007, even though there are 7% more women now of childbearing age. And while the birth rate among teens and women in their 20s and 30s is falling, women in their 40s are having babies at a higher rate than in the past. So why does all this matter? Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
So I'm fine, but people are perplexed by this because we know birth rates tend to fall during recessions, but we're well past the recession. What are the theories about why this is happening?
You know, I think it boils down to the PTSD of the Great Recession, which I prefer to think of that stretch as the Great Reset or maybe the Great Rethink. Jobs for young people were just so much harder to come by, and it wasn't abnormal to move back in with your parents. The student loan suddenly felt especially cumbersome. And so you can understand why moms and young couples didn't feel as confident on the family building front.
Yeah, and so there's that. But then why do we care so much? I mean, obviously, you know, we care about infants and babies, but why do we care so much that the rate is dropping? What does that mean economically?
Look at the extreme example of Japan, which has been stagnant now for a quarter century and has a demographic crisis on our hands. We know that there has to be enough young people in the system being born to subsidize the safety net for retirees, you know, healthcare, Social Security. So while we're nowhere near what Japan faces now, where, for example, there are more diapers being bought for adults than for babies, you know, the lack of recharge of fresh blood, you know, tomorrow's workers has labor and demography people wondering.
Well, if you have a rate that's too high, a birth rate too high, then you have problems because you have a strain on resources like housing or education. But as you say, too low, and you don't have a workforce to replace and or people to take care of the older people. But in the U.S., we understand decline in birth rates haven't led to huge drops in the population, in part because of immigration.
That's right. I mean, look, you need a surge of human capital to strive, to educate. I mean, in older times, to kind of run the factory lines. If the younger people feel like their prospects are kind of so-so, you are going to see a shrinking pool of workers that you have to subsidize in some other way through immigration. If not, you might have to run a deficit as a government or even cut services or benefits for older people. But as we know now, just kind of opening the gates to immigration is hugely controversial on its own.
Yeah, sure is. Look, the countries that have had these falling rates have tried to turn around the rates. Does that work?
Easy to do when that – I mean, it's easier said than done. Like right. Singapore, very developed country, very prosperous country, in many circles egalitarian. The government has begged young people to go out and date and feel like they can multiply. But as education comes up, as women feel like they can freeze their eggs, it's a hard sell. But you look at the flip side of a country that becomes a theocracy and the government takes its eye off the birth control ball and then it has to focus on reducing population growth. So it's a very tricky task for any planning economy.
Yeah. Well, meantime, we've got to just underscore, teen birth rates continue to fall, down 7% last year, down 70% since the peak in 1991. This is the good news. Robin Farzad, who hosts the podcast, Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's time now for a special bluegrass edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
I am a man of constant sorrow.
We were waltzing that night in Kentucky beneath a beautiful harvest moon.
Mike Shirky is DJ and host of The Pick and Post on KUAF in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, and tell us about your show, which, by the way, has been on the air since 1980.
My show is an eclectic show. It's not really a folk show, and it's not a bluegrass. I play everything from a little bit of jazz and some gospel and bluegrass and singer-songwriter.
And is it mostly new stuff, or are you playing the oldies?
I'm playing more songs and albums that are 20 years old. I don't particularly try to keep up with all the new stuff because it's just overwhelming.
Okay.
As you know.
All right, well, let's get to some of the music that you brought us, starting with Nashville-based Kate Campbell. This is her song, Strangeness of the Day.
Oh, they say we're made of atoms that are much too small to see, and our world is just a part of at least a million galaxies. Well, I couldn't say for certain, I just take it all on faith, but I can't help but wonder at the strangeness of the day. Most of our moments we live unaware, while miracles happen around everywhere.
So tell us about Kate Campbell.
Kate was born in Mississippi, but raised mostly in Alabama. Her father was a Baptist preacher, and she was thrown right into the middle of the civil rights movement back in the early 60s and mid-60s. And she's got a beautiful voice, and also she has a great sense of humor. She has, oh, for instance, she lives in Nashville now, but she was driving in Mississippi and came across a sign that said, tomatoes and Jesus coming soon. And so, bingo, there's a song that she wrote about the tomatoes and Jesus.
She says on her website that she's trying to carry on the tradition of writers like Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner. Do you hear that in her songwriting?
That's a strong company to keep.
Yeah.
And it's true.
Now, one of the things that's interesting is that this song came out on her latest release, the KOA Tapes, Volume 1. Many of the basic tracks on that album were actually recorded on an iPhone in her living room. Yeah, by the way, listeners may not know this, but probably half the interviews you hear on Here and Now are recorded on an iPhone these
Days really?
Because the technology's great, but that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
All right, let's listen to the next one. This is Pompadour by country bluegrass musician Tim O'Brien.
Now most days I wake up early, but when the birds start to sing, I'm beside the sleeping beauty. She's the one who wears my ring. Well, I tried hard not to wake her. I got up and I tiptoed out, but when I looked in the bathroom mirror, I gave out a rowdy shout. A pompadour, it was a pompadour.
So tell us why you chose this song.
Oh, he's played with just about anybody that you can think of in Nashville, and or they played with him. And he's just that good. Everything he does is just...
Well, and I read that he not only sings, but he plays the guitar, the fiddle, the mandolin, the banjo, the mandocello, and
mandocello,
something called a bouzouki. Yeah.
That's correct. Now, they're similar, but the mandocello, that's his, probably his main instrument and guitar. And also, of course, they have he has the group Hot Rods. And then they also have alter egos of Red Knuckles and the Trailblazers, this Western swing group, and they've got 10 albums between them, the Hot Rods,
wow.
And it's just really good, great, hard-driving music.
So he's a busy guy.
He's a busy guy,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, up next we have Steve Fisher with No Ordinary Life.
There is no ordinary life. There is no baseline normal. Like wolf or lamb, like dove or eagle, no, no. We have language and free will. If we know what that means, if it's more than creating words like God and machine.
So what is he singing about here?
Well, I think what he's singing about there is just the fact, is straight what it says, is no ordinary life, that we try to put people in the categories and we shouldn't do it.
Hmm.
He's one of these songwriters that there are lots of them who are really good, really gifted, but are not very well known, you know, out in the public.
Okay, the next artist is Canadian, Willie P. Bennett. This is called Last Word.
There's a caveman reaching for a mystery that starts way back in his history, affecting you and me and us and them. Who's gonna get the last word in? Who's gonna make the first step forward? Get on your feet, man, if you're so bold. The air in here is cut pretty thin. Who's gonna get the last word in? Tell me who's gonna get. Tell me who's gonna get. Tell me who's going to get.
So what more should we know about Willie P. Bennett?
Willie P., well, he's passed away a few years ago, but what you should know about Willie, he was really prolific with the bands that he played with in Canada. That particular album, Heartstrings, is what that's off of. It won a Grammy. You know, it's called a Juno in Alaska, in Canada. And every song on that CD... it's just really good. It's hard a choice to decide which one to play. It's one of my favorite albums.
Okay, well, for our last song, we have Sweet Temptation. This is a song by The Special Consensus.
Sweet temptation, that's what you are to me. That's all you'll always be, it seems. Sweet temptation, you smile and pass me by. But still you occupy my dreams. Now maybe I've got lots of hidden charms, and you'd find out if you'd hold me in your arms. But you're just sweet temptation, a diamond in the rough. You make it awful tough on me.
Now the Special Consensus is led by the banjoist Greg Cahill. Why did you want to play this song?
Well, it's just an example of the bluegrass music that this band does. They've got almost, I think, 20 recordings out, and they are just now celebrating the 40th year of the band. They've changed members over the years. Greg will often have the youngsters playing with him, and they can sort of move on to something else. But he's kept this band, Special Consensus, going on for 40 years now, and he just does a whole lot to promote, you know, kids learning music, and particularly bluegrass, and he's just an all-around good guy, which is what you see a lot in bluegrass music.
What are you looking for when you listen to bluegrass music? What makes something stand out?
Oh, I think the vocals and the story of the song, it's always different, and also the course, the ability of the musicians, what they're playing, but the harmony singing is what I like a lot.
Well, I can tell by listening to your voice why you've been on the radio so long. You've got a great radio voice. And it's been great having you here today. Mike Shirky.
Well, thank you.
DJ and host of The Pick and Post on KUAF in Fayetteville, Arkansas. A great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You're just sweet temptation, a diamond in the rough. You make it awful tough on me.
What happens when you increase math and science requirements in high school, make the programs more rigorous? Well, you might think that students will be more stressed, get less sleep, act out. And that could be true for some. But according to a recent study in the American Journal of Health Economics, increasing math requirements is correlated with decreased risky behaviors outside school. The study followed more than 100,000 students in 47 states over 10 years. It found that kids in schools where laws required increased math and sciences decreased their binge drinking and drug use. Washington State University professor and economist Benjamin Cowan co-authored the study with Zhuang Hao, and Professor Cowan joins us. What kind of data did you use?
Well, we used data from the Youth Risky Behavior Study. It's a survey of high school students done by the CDC and reported levels of risky behaviors, including heavy drinking and other kinds of substance use, are high among teens. We looked at whether states that required students to take more math and science courses to receive a high school diploma, whether changes in those requirements were correlated with changes in reported risky behavior, and found that reported binge drinking drops when those requirements go into effect.
Both you and I are using the word correlated instead of caused. You don't know if the more rigorous math and science requirements caused less risky behavior, but there certainly seems to be a connection.
That's true. So in an observational data kind of study, it's very difficult to pin down causality. At the same time, we use several different kinds of robustness checks to make sure that this correlation holds up. And it gives, you know, certainly some evidence to there being a causal connection, though we stop short of saying that we know that for sure.
Yeah. Well, a couple questions. This seems to be more prevalent, the decrease, among males in general. Some have said that's because young men tend to binge drink and abuse alcohol more than women do, so they had more to decrease. But why is this correlation, this decrease in risky behavior, more prevalent among non-white males?
We think that it may be the case that students of color attending high schools in the United States may be attending schools that are more likely to change their high school requirements when the law changes. Some high schools, particularly those in maybe more affluent areas, are already requiring their students to have the higher number of math and science courses. Hmm. And so that's one potential explanation, though it's only one of many.
In other words, you can see the change because there's been a change in the requirements, and then you can see the result of that. But what about those who say, look, if you have more rigorous requirements for math and science, that is something that produces tremendous stress in some people, and it might cause more people to drop out, which skews your findings.
I'll say a couple of things about that. One is that we took considerable measures to try to rule that out as a possibility. So one thing we did is we actually looked directly at whether students are more likely to drop out with an increase in the high school requirement. And we did not find evidence that that was the case in our study period. Mm-hmm. The second thing we did is we dropped older students who tend to be more likely to have left high school. And with younger students, for which dropout rates are very low, we continued to find evidence of an effect of the requirements on their drinking activity.
So what do we do with this? Because we also know that there are, you know, many young people, as we said, who, you know, more rigorous math and science requirements, if they're in schools that don't have, you know, special instruction for kids with challenges, would not be good.
You raise some important points, and we see this, you know, our study fitting into a much larger picture about how best to help young people. So we would not suggest that in any circumstance that a magic bullet is to make whatever curriculum a school has more rigorous. There may be cases where it's already plenty rigorous. There may be students who would need special attention if their curriculum were to become more rigorous. So we see this not as being the only thing to say on this subject, but almost certainly fitting into a larger picture and with the goal of helping all young people do as well as they can.
And why do you think it's showing up? I mean, some have speculated that it's simply, if you have more work to do, you have less time for stupid stuff, you know? That's why some schools are extending school years and school hours. Why do you think it is?
Certainly how they spend their time, you know, and if that changes with respect to the rigor of their courses at school could be one pathway. Another potential pathway is that by increasing the rigor of high school courses, they start to become more interested in post-secondary education, in college, and in different kinds of career paths. And that leads them to make different choices in the present about what they're willing to take a risk on.
That's Benjamin Cowan, professor of economics at Washington State University. His recent study in the American Journal of Health Economics is The Effects of Graduation Requirements on Risky Health Behaviors of High School Students. We'll post it. His conclusions were there's a correlation between more rigorous requirements, math, science, and less risky behavior. Professor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.